Hello and welcome to the Backtracker History Show podcast with me, Alice. Join me as we go on a gentle stroll through the archives to discover intriguing tales about people and events that happened in the past. Each episode is a podcast-friendly version of a show that's been aired on Bradleystoke Radio in Bristol, England, all of which will be brought to life by an array of amazing voice talent from across the world. We have stories about a huge variety of subjects, from activists to war heroes. We've got it all. So get ready for the latest installment of the Backtracker History Show, bringing the past back to life. The event we'll be talking about today occurred in the year 1950, and as usual, we'll be looking at some of the other things that happened that year. One of the major events in the UK was the general election, which was held on the 23rd of February. This election saw the Labour Party, led by Clement Attlee, winning a narrow victory over the Conservative Party. This victory allowed Labour to remain in power, albeit with a much reduced majority compared to the landslide victory they achieved in 1945. Another major event of 1950 was the Korean War, when North Korean forces, backed by the Soviet Union and China, invaded South Korea. The UK, as a member of the United Nations, joined the conflict by sending military support to South Korea as part of the UN force. This war had significant implications for international relations and the Cold War dynamics between the West and the Communist bloc. The Education Act of 1950 was passed, which aimed to increase the provision of secondary education in the UK. This act represented a continuation of post-war educational reforms and aimed to make secondary education more accessible to children across the country. On the 7th of June, the pilot episode of the agricultural soap opera The Archers aired on BBC Radio. The series proper begins in January 1951 and is still running over 70 years later. The NHS, which had been established in 1948, continued to develop and expand its services throughout the 1950s. While not a new development in 1950, the NHS remained a significant feature of British society, providing free healthcare to all citizens and becoming a cornerstone of the welfare state. These are just a few of the things that were happening in the UK during a period of post-war recovery, social change, and international tension during the early years of the Cold War. But our event happened on the afternoon of the 20th of September, when Mrs. Ethel Mirinda Worth was just relaxing at her home in Hughenden Road, Horfield, Bristol. The defence in this Horfield murder case tried to use the plea of insanity on behalf of a man charged with the murder of a Horfield widow at Bristol Assizes. After hearing evidence for the defence, the court adjourned until the next day. And the accused was Edward Isaac Woodfield, aged 49, a labourer who lived in Southmead Road in Bristol. He was charged with the murder of 65-year-old Mrs. Ethel Mirinda Worth at her home in Hughenden Road, Horfield, on September the 20th, 1950. Mr. J.D. Caswell, who, with Mr. Kenneth Bain, represented Woodfield, said,
"The defence here is one of insanity to this extent that this man was not responsible for the brutal attack on this old lady."
Opening the case, Mr. John Maud, who was a prosecutor, with Mr. Michael Lavington, said that when Mr. Frederick George Worth, aged 35, returned home at 5:30 p.m. after a day working at the Bristol Aircraft Company, he found his mother in the sitting room in her favourite chair. At first, he thought she must be having a nap. Her face was covered with a brick-coloured woolly coat. He removed the coat and she still didn't move. That's when he noticed the blood coming from a severe head wound, and on further examination, he found she was dead. It would later be determined that, without a shadow of a doubt, she'd been strangled, and evidence shown she'd been hit on the head with a blunt instrument.
Word on the street.
The word I give you this week is spinster, which nowadays means a woman who hasn't been married. But did you know it comes from the late 14th century spinestra, woman who spins, or female spinner of thread, because unmarried women were expected to occupy themselves at that time with spinning. And so, in documents from the 1600s to early 1900s, the word came to be the legal designation in England of all unmarried women from a viscount's daughter downward. And by 1719, was being used generically for all women still unmarried and beyond the usual age of it. Personally, I've never really liked the title. Edward Woodfield was known to visit the house, and he was seen in the road. And so the day after the crime, he was asked to go to police headquarters, and the police officer asked him to be careful about what he said, as Hugbenland Road is very short, and if Woodfield had been there the day before, there's a very good chance someone had seen him. The questioning was led by Detective Superintendent Melbourne Phillips, who said that at first, Woodfield just commented that he'd been at the Labour Exchange in the morning, then went home to dinner and bed. But the comment by the police officer whilst he'd been waiting about the possibility of being seen must have been playing on his mind. Because after a while he became distressed, laid his head in his arms and started crying, saying that it was a mad impulse. After he broke down, Woodfield made a statement to Detective Superintendent Phillips, in which he said,
"I want to tell the truth, the whole truth. While one was having my dinner, I thought I could get a couple of pounds out of poor Mrs. Worth. My gaze fell on a lemonade bottle in the room, and after dinner I put it in my pocket. I went straight up to Mrs. Worth's house and knocked the door. She came to the door and I put my hand in the inside breast pocket of my jacket. I think I pulled the wallet out a little. One wanted Mrs. Worth to think I was going to pay her the pound I borrowed from her on Monday. As I followed her through the passage to the back room, I struck her on the head with the lemonade bottle. A mad impulse came over me to do it. I didn't hit the old lady very hard. She went to the back room and sat in the chair. I hit her again with the bottle when she was in the chair. I don't think they were hard blows because I got frightened. She said, 'Don't, Ted.' I was afraid if she came too, I should be caught, so I just squeezed her round the throat. I put on an old pair of gloves when I squeezed her. I then took some money from the handbag in the cupboard in the room and went upstairs. I took a watch from a bedroom and I also took a pair of field glasses from the back room upstairs. I then left the house, leaving the front door open, and I started to walk home. At Horfield Common, I threw the gloves and bottle away, then I went home and made a cup of tea. It was about 4:20 then. I put the watch into a cigarette case and buried it with the field glasses just outside the back door. By then it was 5 o'clock, and I got tea ready for my wife. She goes out to work. Later that night, I felt I had to get rid of the money. I took my wife to the Beehive and bought some drinks. I could not stay in. I thought the police would be coming for me. I spent an awful night."
Superintendent Phillips would tell the court that he had found a pair of gloves in a disused allotment site in Horfield, and under rubbish in Woodfield's back garden, he found a cigarette case containing a gold watch. The binoculars were also found there. All these were items that were missing from Ethel's house. Detective Chief Inspector Jesse Payne said that he went back to Horfield Common and found a lemonade bottle in the undergrowth. When Woodfield was shown this, he exclaimed,
"That's the one."
Mr. Casewell, opening the case for the defence, declared that Woodfield was the last man expected to commit acts of violence against an old woman. He said Woodfield's father's mother and sister had been in Gloucester Asylum. His father's brother had died from a blood clot on the brain, and another member of the family had died from meningitis. And his mother had suffered from delusions. In 1947, Woodfield had had an attack when bending. He'd felt a click in his head and then instantly developed double vision. The defence surmised that Woodfield had been suffering from some sort of mental breakdown. Mr. George Edward Checketts of the Bristol Aeroplane Company said Woodfield left the factory of his own accord. He was an excellent employee in every way, popular, respectful, and respected. But when the prosecution started, they came in with full force, saying,
"There is no doubt whatsoever that the man in the dock killed her." Word on the street.
This week, join me as we venture forth to BS16 in Bristol and Hermitage Road, which was named after a house that once stood here, described by the Reverend Emlyn Jones in his History of Mangotsfield as being the prettiest homestead in the parish. One occupant was a Mr. Lanaway, after whom a road in Downend is named, followed by a Mr. Vinning in 1870. In 1882, a Mr. Renane was living there and the house was demolished before 1905. All the evidence, as well as the items stolen from Ethel, were taken to E.B. Parks, the director of the Home Office Southwest Forensic Science Laboratory in Bristol. And he said that he'd found human blood smears on the bottom of the bottle. He also found blood on the gloves. Mr. Maud, the prosecutor, reiterated that the bottle and gloves were found on Horfield Common. He told the court,
"We say that this man killed her, struck her with a bottle taken to the premises for the purpose of a weapon. And having done that, he became frightened, as he said, and strangled her. He took to the house not only the bottle, but his wife's gloves, and actually stole from the house. He knew perfectly well what he was doing and had an excellent memory of what happened. You don't want to go hunting around for motives. Sometimes people are murdered because a fellow wants money. This man was actuated by greed, and he planned the theft and murdered her."
Frederick Worth, the victim's son, said in the witness box that he had never known Woodfield, or Ted as he was known to them, to be violent. His mother was very generous and kind, he added. Detective Superintendent Phillips said Woodfield appeared very confident and seemed to have nothing on his mind at all at the police headquarters until he was told that someone might have seen him in Hughenden Road. That was when the signs of fear started to appear on his face. And after saying she'd been married to Woodfield for 19 years, Catherine gave her statement in court, starting with the questioning by the defence.
"During the time that you have been married to him, what would you say of his characteristics? Was he a violent man?"
"He was the kindest man I've ever known. I've never known him to be violent."
"Has he ever lost his temper with you?"
"No."
"Have you ever seen him do anything violent?"
"I cannot say he ever did. He hated the sight of blood, and on one occasion, when he'd seen a road accident, he couldn't eat anything at all."
"Have you ever seen him do anything violent?"
"No, never."
"You remember what happened on the morning of September 20?
"I was just going out when the post came. My husband took in a letter, which was from the Bristol Aeroplane Company. He opened it and I read it over his shoulder."
"What did he do with the letter?"
"He was very upset and rolled it into a ball and threw it across the room. I've never known him to do that before."
Catherine told the court that the letter was from his employer, BAC, saying that they could not re-employ him. He thought it was because of his dermatitis, which was quite bad, and she was worried about him during the day and felt she wanted to go back to the house, and so she did as soon as she could. The questioning continued.
Did you notice anything unusual about him when you got home?
No.
He was just normal?
Yes.
Next morning, you went to work again. Did he seem normal or different from usual?
Just as usual.
You knew nothing about the occurrence until next day?
No.
Have you seen your husband on various occasions since?
Yes.
Has he ever discussed this incident with you at all?
No.
During the questioning, Catherine did say one morning in 1947, her husband had said,
I can see double of everything.
He then had to go to the eye hospital for treatment for about 6 weeks. During cross-examination, Catherine said her husband was very reserved. He did not tell her that he had been borrowing money from Mrs. Worth, and as far as she knew, he was not in debt. In fact, she said that with her working as well, life for the couple was comfortable. The prosecution continued questioning Catherine.
When you saw him in prison, he seemed perfectly normal?
Yes.
Any reason why you should not speak to him about the incident?
No.
Dr. Charles Robert Gibson of Wellesley Bath said he had had many years' experience examining people with mental illnesses. He had seen Woodfield on 4 occasions in prison, and he said,
In 4 examinations I carried out, I could not find any definite evidence of present insanity.
He went on to say that the family mental history was particularly bad, primarily due to the blood vessel supply to the brain, which was faulty. The blood vessels were abnormally hard. A specialist stated that in 1947, around the same time he started getting double vision, Woodfield had been found by neurologists to have a clot of blood on the midbrain and hardening of the blood vessels, which caused abnormal violent reactions to trivial upsets.
What is likely to be the result?
That the brain is likely to lead to completely abnormal violent reactions in response to very small stimuli or stress.
Dr. Gibson said that from his examination he could not say conclusively that Woodfield did or did not know. He might have lost control from the time he followed Mrs. Worth along the corridor. In re-examination, Dr. Gibson said it was quite possible for the man to be insane at the time and for there to be no evidence 2 months later. Dr. Gibson said the particular area where the clot of blood was, in the midbrain, was very near the area of the brain which was the centre of emotional control. And so Woodfield would be vulnerable to emotional stress, and voluntary control of his actions would be at least very difficult. In cross-examination, Dr. Gibson said that the letter about his job at BAC could have set off a high-stress situation for Woodfield, which would cause a violent state of emotion, uncharacteristic for him. Mr. Maud asked if being arrested or questioned by the police or even his appearance in court would not cause Woodfield stress. The doctor replied that it was quite impossible in that form of low emotional control to predict what form the stress would take. Mr. Maud said that from his statement, Woodfield knew quite well what he was doing. In the end, the jury took only 2 hours and 45 minutes to issue a guilty verdict after the 2-day trial at the Bristol Assizes in November 1950. When asked if he had anything to say after the verdict, Woodfield said,
God knows best.
Mr. Justice Devlin then pronounced the death sentence. He did appeal, but this was dismissed, and Edward Isaac Woodfield was hanged by Albert Pierpoint, assisted by Herbert Allen, at Horfield Prison in Bristol on Thursday, the 14th of December, 1950. A little bit more about Edward Isaac Woodfield. He was born on the 26th of January 1901 and married Catherine Shawnee in 1931. On the 1939 census, he's listed as living at 26 St. Paul's Road with his wife and a Herbert and Agnes Bradford. Woodfield was listed as a boot and shoe warehouseman. Whilst doing the research for this particular story, I did find some other newspaper articles regarding Edward Woodfield. They're about an Edward Isaac Woodfield born the same time as the one we've been talking about. But, you know, you can't be too careful with records, so I'm not going to conclusively say it's the same person, but it does seem quite likely. The first article is in the Western Daily Press of Monday, the 28th of March, 1927, saying that an Edward Isaac Woodfield, born around 1901, was caught in a sting operation to find out who was stealing money from a Mr. Henry Headley's wife at Fern House, Clifton Down. Woodfield had been employed as a gardener for 3 years, and on Friday, the 25th of March, 1927, Mrs. Headley had, on the advice of Inspector Lush of the Bristol CID, deliberately left her bag out in the kitchen, after she had reported that money had been going missing over a long period of time, but only recently in larger amounts. Her handbag had contained 6 £1 notes, but after she'd left it for 5 minutes and returned, it was missing two. Interestingly, suspicion had been on the maids and not Woodfield. PC Clark gave evidence about the arrest and said that Woodfield admitted taking the money since Christmas and thought he had about £20. He said he'd been very tempted but would pay back all the money. In the end, he was sentenced to 1 month in prison with a previous conviction being taken into account. But it's this next news report from the Western Daily Press of the 22nd of March 1932 that tells another story that might make you rethink whether Woodfield was as meek as people thought he was. Woodfield was brought up before C.T. Budgett, chairman of the Bristol Magistrates, on the 21st of March 1932. During the course of the hearing, Budgett had said that you are a dangerous man to let loose on the public, and Woodfield, who was then 31 and living in St. Michael's Park, St. Michael's, Bristol, was sent to prison for 3 months, hard labour, for being found on March the 14th in the Clergy Daughters' School, Great George Street, Park Street, Bristol, with the intent to commit a felony. He was also accused of stealing 2 cash boxes containing over £15 from a cupboard in the school in the October. In today's money, that's £871. Miss Marjorie Alford, the secretary of the school, said she went to a classroom and found Woodfield behind the door. He came out and said something about being on the wrong floor and taps. He had a screwdriver in his hand. He was then seen off the premises, but it was later discovered that a cupboard in the room had been damaged by someone trying to force it open. It was the same cupboard that the £15 had been taken from the previous October. And later, Marjorie Alford said she picked out Woodfield from a line of men at Brandon Hill Police Station. Woodfield was stated to have said to Constable Tandy of the CID,
"I went there. I was hard up."
At the hearing, Woodfield pleaded, saying that he'd only been married for 4 months and he wanted another chance to make a fresh start with his new wife.
What's up, everybody? It's your boy, Zach.
It's Josh. Zach, do you enjoy video games, drinking, and attempting to solve the world's problems through ridiculous schemes?
Yeah.
Do you think others would enjoy that?
I mean, I really hope so.
So do I. So I think you all should come spend some time with us, the Midwest Meltdown. This show was created by these two fine gentlemen here, myself and Zach, when we spent the last 14 years telling each other funny stories, talking about video games, and literally anything else that comes to mind. We wanted to turn our passion for gaming into something that we could share with everyone. So again, follow us, the Midwest Meltdown, anywhere you can find your podcasts. That's Spotify, Apple Music, Podbean, Google Pods. Check us out. We'd be happy to have you.
Today, I am genuinely shocked that someone broke into my house and stole all my fruit. In fact, I'm peachless.
Back in the day facts.
And so we start with the 20th of April, 1657, when an English fleet under Admiral Robert Blake penetrated the heavily defended harbour at Santa Cruz de Tenerife in the Spanish Canary Islands and attacked their treasure fleet. The treasure had already been landed and was safe, but the English engaged the harbour forts and the Spanish ships, many of which were scuttled and the remainder burnt. Having achieved his aim, Blake withdrew without losing any ships. On the 21st of April, 1947, James Newell Osterberg, better known as Iggy Pop, American singer, songwriter, producer and actor, was born. On the 22nd of April, 1993, 18-year-old Stephen Lawrence is murdered in a racially motivated attack while waiting for a bus in Well Hall, Eltham, London. The case became a cause célèbre. Its fallout included changes of attitudes on racism and the police, and to the law and police practice. It also led to the partial revocation of the rule against double jeopardy. Two of the perpetrators were convicted of murder on the 3rd of January, 2012. On the 23rd of April, 1927, Cardiff City defeat Arsenal in the FA Cup final, the only time it has been won by a team not based in England. The 24th of April, 1916, and Ernest Shackleton and five men of the Imperial Transantarctic Expedition launch a lifeboat from uninhabited Elephant Island in the Southern Ocean to organise a rescue for the crew of the sunken Endurance. On the 25th of April, 1859, British and French engineers break ground for the Suez Canal. And lastly, the 26th of April, 1986, sees the Chernobyl disaster occurring in the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. It is only one of only two nuclear energy accidents rated at 7, the maximum severity, on the International Nuclear Event Scale, the other being the 2011 Fukushima nuclear accident in Japan. Chernobyl, though, is considered the worst nuclear disaster in history. Well, my friends, I fear that's the end of today's show, but don't worry, I'll be here, same time, same place, next week. You've been listening to me, Alice, on the Backtracker History Show, and as always, I'd like to thank those who brought today's story to life. And this week, we have the amazing voice talents of our very own Steve Shepherd, as well as Steve Yeo, Joe Wilson, Molly Jeffries, and Sam Roberts from St. Stephen's Drama Group, right here in Bristol. Thank you, one and all. Thank you once again for listening to me, Alice, on the Backtracker History Show. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can find me on Twitter or Facebook by looking up at Backtracker UK with a capital B, a capital T, and a capital UK. I also occasionally post onto TikTok and Instagram. So do come along and find me, because it's amazing to hear from you and get some feedback or even ideas for future shows. As a small independent podcaster, your help and support is always appreciated. And one way you can do that is to rate the show wherever you get your podcasts. Leaving a review also helps, as it gives other people an idea of what the show's about. The show is regularly released on Mondays. So until next time, guys, take care and look after each other.